This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, February 22nd, 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Support for Ozarks at Large and KUAF provided by the Malco Razorback Cinema in Fayetteville and the Fort Smith Cinema, featuring Andrew Lloyd Webber's Love Never Dies, Tuesday, February 28th. This Phantom of the Opera continuation begins at 7:30 p.m. Tickets and more information available on the web at malco.com.
Later, Gerald Sloan's first full-length book of poetry has been published by Half Acre Press and is titled Paper Lanterns. He'll talk to Kyle about and read from the book, plus how a church congregation's desire to get fit turned into a 5K this weekend.
And we begin this edition of Ozarks at Large with an update on the expansion of Walton Arts Center. It was in 2008 that the venue first began the process of studying if and how to expand its facilities. Last year's initial plan included construction of a new 2,200-seat center in Bentonville and a new smaller venue in Fayetteville. Yesterday, an updated plan developed by the Schuler Shook Theater Planning Firm was released that has some modifications to that blueprint. Terry Trotter is the Chief Operating Officer at Walton Arts Center. She's with me inside the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio. Welcome back.
Thanks, Kyle. It's nice to be here.
Well, thank you. This new report confirms, first of all, the need for a new smaller venue in Fayetteville, about 600-700 seats?
Correct.
I guess the big change is that now the idea is the footprint might be on campus.
Well, that's correct. We went into the study because we really wanted to validate this concept that, you know, the 2008 study had put forward, which was two new venues, a 2,000-seat and a 600-seat. Subsequent to that, you know, the board had decided that it made the most sense to really separate those venues rather than, you know, not put them all in one place, but do the larger theater in Bentonville and the smaller theater in Fayetteville to go along with, you know, our current 1,200-seat theater. So that was really what we set out to look at. You know, does that make sense? Is the community need there? And then to dig a little deeper to say, what do those buildings really need to have in them? You know, it's fine to say a 600-seat theater
right.
or a 1,200-seat theater, but what are all the things that you need to go along with to make the buildings functional? So that's what the study did. What we were really excited about, you're right, there was a little bit of a change we didn't anticipate, which was the university's real interest in this project. I mean, we've been a partner with the university, you know, from the very beginning. So we were working with them. But what we discovered, and I think they discovered as we really went through the study and did some visioning about the building, is that mid-sized theater is going to be largely used by the university, particularly the music department.
The symphony orchestra, the wind orchestra.
Yes. And, I mean, not only what they're currently doing, but they, you know, the university has grown so substantially in the past 20 years, you know, just like Northwest Arkansas and some of the same issues that we face at Walton Arts Center with the growth. And, you know, they have a lot of vision for new programming and other things that they can do to grow their department. But they are challenged by the fact that it's difficult for students to access the facility, both because we have competing needs, mm-hmm. but also because it's too far away. The students can't get there between classes, so they can't do a rehearsal in there and things. So all of this sort of bubbled to the surface through the study, which of course was the purpose to really ascertain what are the issues, what are the needs. What we got very excited about was when the university and particularly the chancellor stood up and said, you know, this is really important you know, clearly the community needs it. Clearly the university needs it. And we have great interest in seeing this happen to the point of we think we might be able to do it on our campus, which means that we get the venue, but the university would also take on, you know, the fundraising for that building, which what that does for us is allow us to sort of shift our focus and our resources to our current building. Because the other thing we learned in this study is there are really a lot of needs on the Walton Arts Center campus itself. You know, and we want to make sure that our building is really functioning as well as it can, as full as it can. Star Theater, which is a fantastic black box theater, honestly, is used for storage a lot of the time. Our consultant called it the most expensive storage closet he'd ever seen.
And would that be like storage if a Broadway show comes in and they've got things to...
That's absolutely right. So, you know, the theater wasn't, you know, we never intended to be doing, 20 years ago, the thought of us doing first run week-long Broadway tours wasn't in the sights. And so now, for instance, we've got Million Dollar Quartet in there. Star Theater is completely unavailable because there's storage in there, but it's also the wig and makeup area. We have to extend the backstage into that space so that the tours can function. And so, you know, it doesn't allow that theater to actually function as a theater. So between, you know, working on some storage so that we can free up Star Theater, get more performances and more activities and events in there, really open up the lobby. You know, both people have talked about curb appeal of Walton Arts Center. I mean, certainly that's something that would be great to address. But also just expanding that lobby, both for the comfort of patrons who are in there, as well as for, you know, special events and new activities that we can then bring into the building.
The Bentonville venue, trimmed by about a couple hundred seats in this revision?
Yeah, interestingly, the initial study called for 2,200-plus seats to be looked at. There was a lot of study that went into that seat count and really testing this idea of, you know, what is the need? What is the biggest event that people are going to want to put in there? And really, that came back that 2,000 seats will meet the needs. It'll meet some of the corporate needs in terms of meetings and events in there. It'll definitely meet the needs of Walton Arts Center. 2,000 is kind of considered a sweet spot. It's enough seats that you can, you know, make the revenue you need to make for the big shows, but it's not too many that it really sacrifices the intimacy. So the study is suggesting 2,000 seats is a good number. The other thing is, you know, that's the most expensive room to build in your facility. So, you know, every seat you add, it significantly ups the cost. So for a lot of reasons, we don't want to go any bigger than we need to. I mean, you want it to be an intimate space. You want it to be a sustainable space. And you want it to be a cost-effective space. So we really wanted to test in this, what is that number? And they really feel, and I agree, that 2,000 is a great number.
With the plan, there was a chart of what the Walton Arts Center does as far as number of people in the year, how many elementary school students in the year, how many shows, and then what the projection would be 2012 if this plan comes to fruition. And in 2012, if this all happens, the money is raised and things are built, you'll have the 2,000-seat venue in Bentonville, the new smaller venue in Fayetteville, and then a sort of revised on Dixon Street facility?
Correct. Plus the amp.
Plus the amp. Well, let me ask you about that. How does that figure in, especially considering that we don't really know where the amp will be after the summer of 2012?
Right. You know, it's just it's incredible to kind of think about the vision for the future and just about, you know, the way the organization has grown, which is exciting just because of new audiences we're able to serve. I mean, that's one of the great things about the amp is it takes us into a little bit of a different a different audience base, a different type of entertainment, and something that's really been missing in this region. I think 2012, the summer 2012 is stacking up to be a great season at the AMP. We're really excited about the new fairgrounds location. And, you know, where things will go from there, we aren't sure, but I think that's fine. You know, this gives us a really good opportunity to test this season. We have an opportunity to renew that lease for another year. And honestly, the fairgrounds has said, we're really excited about this. If things go well.
So it may stay there.
Maybe. You know, we need to see how it goes.
You're continuing to look at other options?
We're continuing to look at various locations. But, you know, we're also thinking, you know, we're really going to test the water, see what it looks like. But ultimately, we do want to get to a larger permanent venue.
And how much money, then, are you thinking about now?
The study suggested we need about $20 million in renovations. So looking at that. And then in Bentonville, it's about $123 million building, but total project cost of about $160 million. So with an endowment that we'll need to support a new building, it's about a $200 million need.
Right. Terry Trotter is Chief Operating Officer at Walton Arts Center. Thank you for your time.
You bet. Thanks, Kyle.
For more about the Walton Arts Center expansion, including a possible accelerated timeline for the proposed on-campus venue, you can go to our webpage, ozarksatlarge.com. Earlier this month, the cities of Fayetteville and Fort Smith announced plans to collaborate with each other on a number of projects. Last week, a delegation of business and civic leaders from Central Arkansas visited Northwest Arkansas to discuss the possibility of potential partnerships to help the two regions, as well as the state, grow. Ozarks at Large's Ithiagni Hiltre-Madolker reports.
Last week, business and civic leaders from the two largest metropolitan areas in the state, Northwest and Central Arkansas, came together to discuss the possibility of potential partnerships to enhance the economic development of the two regions. The convention was made possible by the Northwest Arkansas Council and 50 for the Future, a branch of the Little Rock Chamber of Commerce. Rob Smith, Communications and Policy Specialist at the Northwest Arkansas Council, says the summit, informally referred to as Northwest Arkansas and Central Arkansas Partnership, is an idea that has been in the works for a couple of years now.
Steve Clark actually mentioned it at the Little Rock Rotary meeting a couple of years ago. He's the head of the Fayetteville Chamber of Commerce. And then there's some credit goes to French Hill, who had the same idea. He was a former chairman of 50 for the Future. They both had the idea, and frankly, several people had the idea that these two regions ought to get together and talk. You know, the goal ultimately was to figure out ways these two regions can work together and we can collaborate.
According to Smith, the Northwest and Central Arkansas Partnership seeks to focus on four specific areas, namely economic development, arts and tourism, transportation, and higher education funding.
Some of the things we quickly identified is that our universities have a funding challenge. If you look at three schools in particular, Northwest Arkansas Community College, Pulaski Tech, and the University of Arkansas, you know, those are three of the largest schools in the state. And when you look at the funding they receive from the state as a percentage of you know, what they need to educate a student, it's lower than a lot of smaller schools in the state. So, you know, one of the challenges figuring out, you know, how to fund a growing school like these.
Smith says the direct and critical relationship between higher education and economic development, especially in Northwest and Central Arkansas, was also a topic of discussion.
Both of these regions, both of our groups, would like to see more people in their communities with college degrees, and there's a lot of ways to address that. You can help people who already have some credits complete degrees, or you can encourage people to go to college. I mean, there's kind of two ways to go about that same goal. And if you lift up and increase the number of people with college degrees, you make your region more attractive to companies that might look to relocate there.
The Northwest and Central Arkansas Partnership Summit, held last Thursday and Friday, was attended by representatives from the Northwest Arkansas Council and 50 for the Future, as well as business and civic leaders from the two regions. The event was held at the Janell Y. Hemry Alumni House on the University of Arkansas campus in Fayetteville and featured a keynote address by Ted Abernathy Jr., the Executive Director of Southern Growth Policies Board, a public policy think tank based in North Carolina. Rob Smith from the Northwest Arkansas Council says Abernathy emphasized the importance of having successes along the way.
You know, we need to hit these little milestones as we go. Not every task we take on needs to be a huge monumental thing. That you need successes along the way. And if you don't find those occasional successes, you drift apart because you don't feel like you're making progress. You know, we go in, Ted talked about this, about, you know, we go in that with the goal of, you know, lifting up Arkansas and making it all about making Arkansas better. And ultimately, you know, the thing, you know, as this super region of Little Rock and North Little Rock, you know, comes together, we're going to have to find things and ways that we do things better than everyone else in the world, that we're a world economy now. We're not just the United States, and we're not just competing against, you know, our neighbors in the next community.
Will Whiting is the Vice President for Advocacy at the Little Rock Chamber of Commerce and a liaison for 50 for the Future, The Central Arkansas organization that's collaborating with the Northwest Arkansas Council to work on potential partnerships.
The purpose of the organization is to identify, develop, and support regional projects and policies that will have a significant long-term positive impact on Central Arkansas.
Whiting says the organization's primary focus areas are public education and workforce development, public safety, and economic development, all overlapping with focus areas of the Northwest and Central Arkansas Partnership. Whiting cites an example of what a collaborative project between the two regions could look like.
Whether it's figuring out how to brand from a tourism perspective, the great things that both regions have. You know, in Central Arkansas, we have the Clinton Presidential Center. In Northwest Arkansas, Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art is now open. So we have two world-class attractions that literally will draw people from around the globe. From an economic development perspective, I think one of the things that we all realize is that if there's a plant that is considering locating its headquarters in Little Rock, in Fayetteville, and in Omaha, and Little Rock is cut from the list, then we should use all of our efforts to get behind Fayetteville getting that plant. It's much more important for Arkansas to win and for Fayetteville to win than for us to lose a project to a state and to another city.
Rob Smith from the Northwest Arkansas Council says the collaboration between Northwest and Central Arkansas is unique, as the two regions have hardly any competing interests.
We are economically different. You know, their strengths are in aerospace, state government. They're a little larger than we are. They have the Arkansas River. They have Dillard's. You know, we have Walmart. We have Tyson. We have J.B. Hunt. We have the state's flagship university. We are somewhat different. And I mean, selfishly, I look at this in Northwest Arkansas as, you know, they're a little ahead of us in terms of growth. And so maybe there's some opportunity to recognize ways they've dealt with transportation challenges. You know, their region is just enough bigger than us that, there's some things we could learn, I'm sure.
Smith anticipates one or two challenges that he says would be easy to overcome.
Certainly, it's great to talk about an idea on the front end, but we want to, you know, ensure that the right folks are in the room as we move on through this process. You know, you would hate to have a lot of the folks who showed up at the first meeting not be there for the second one. And I think we've got a commitment from folks to, you know, stay involved. I mean, that would be one of the challenges. Let's keep all the right people in the room to make these kind of important decisions.
Both Smith and Whiting hope the summit becomes a regular affair, a place where potential partnerships can be discussed on a regular basis. They say the ultimate goal of the Northwest and Central Arkansas collaboration is to benefit the entire state instead of individual regions.
The most obvious long-term goal is, you know, together we're stronger. You know, if your region is bigger, you draw more attention. When you speak, more people listen, I guess is the simplest way to say it. And really, when you talk about the state of Arkansas, you know, it's Central Arkansas and Northwest Arkansas who are really the economic engines of the state. And so if you lift those boats up, you know, the rest of the state comes with it.
We believe that collaboration is extremely important to moving Arkansas forward. And so this is this was our first attempt at making that possible, and the enthusiasm and the energy and the interest that was displayed by members of both organizations to continue moving this partnership along is something that I think will help us have future meetings as we continue to go down this road together.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Iti Agnihotri Mudholkar.
Ahead on Ozarks, several faiths will gather in one room this weekend for the fourth annual Interfaith Harmony Day in Fayetteville. And one church congregation discovered many of its members wanted to get in better shape. Now they are sponsoring a 5K Saturday. That's ahead on Ozarks at Large.
Earth, sky, Considering Earth as a whole, the year 2011 had the highest economic losses due to earthquakes on record. It also had the highest economic losses due to natural disasters overall on record.
The earthquake analysis, released in early 2012, came from the Center for Disaster Management and Risk Reduction in Germany. According to their report, earthquakes and their consequences, such as tsunamis and landslides, caused damages of $365 billion U.S. dollars. Over half of that was from the earthquake on March 11th of 2011 and the resulting tsunami in Japan.
The report said that the two countries hardest hit by earthquakes were New Zealand, with a large earthquake near Christchurch in February 2011, and Japan. The Insurance Information Institute in the U.S. and the global reinsurance firm Munich Re in Germany both issued reports calling the Japan earthquake the most costly natural disaster of any kind in history.
Globally, the Institute said, 2011 was the costliest year ever for natural disasters, and the earthquake and tsunami in Japan were a big part of that. They accounted for more than half of the total damage from natural disasters worldwide. I'm Jorge Salazar.
And I'm Deborah Bird. For more, come to earthsky.org and search for natural disasters. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
It is Wednesday, February 22nd, 2012. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
And joining us now is Becca Bacon-Martin, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
You really must go to Fort Smith.
I like going to Fort Smith.
Well, you really must go tomorrow night.
Why is that?
Because it is the final Arkansas performance of something that's been going on for some time. It's a little show called Riverdance.
Ah. Huh. It's the final Arkansas. They've had it with us?
Well, yeah. They are actually closing the U.S. tour in June.
Gotcha.
And I got to talk to Katerina Coyne, who is the principal female dancer. And I said, well, what are you going to do? Because she's been doing this for 7 years, mm-hmm. since she was a baby. And she said, oh, they're planning to tour places like South America that they've never been.
Oh, okay.
So that's something to look forward to.
They'll still be dancing, but they won't be dancing here.
Tonight they're dancing here.
No, tomorrow night they're dancing here.
Yes, and
but
where
Fort
he?
Smith.
Yes, for yes.
Thursday they're dancing here at the. Will you quit listening to him and listen to me? 7:30 tomorrow.
Right.
Arkansas Best Performing Arts Center. Tickets start at $55. You can call 800-965-9324 or visit www.itickets.com.
Seriously, your last chance to see them unless you're really going to travel.
Exactly.
Okay. Becca Bacon-Martin is the features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. Muslims and Methodists, Presbyterians and Buddhists, and many more will gather together Saturday afternoon for the 4th Annual Interfaith Harmony Day at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Fayetteville. The 3.5-hour drop-in will allow anybody to ask questions about any of the faiths represented. In addition, there will be song, dance, and verse connected to the faiths performed throughout the afternoon. Diane Cook is one of the organizers of Interfaith Harmony Day.
I became involved last year as part of Episcopal Peace Fellowship, which is something in my church. And so we got an opportunity. We heard about it, and so we got involved, a friend of mine and I, and started working on it last year. And I was so excited to actually see the day because we were working on it. I'd never attended it. So last year was actually the first time I attended, and it was very, very cool.
For those who don't know, it is, what, a 2.5-hour?
Yeah, 2, 3, 4. Actually, 3.5 hours.
3.5 hours. And over the 3.5 hours, people of all sorts of different faiths will do all sorts of different things.
Yes. The one thing that's part of it is each faith group can have a display table. And we have about 18 different groups that will have displays. And they can display whatever they choose. brochures, icons of their church or their faith group or their tradition, whatever they want on their display table. And many of the groups will also bring dessert or, you know, candy or something like that to have at their table, which is nice because you can kind of stop and talk with the person and have a little something and learn about what religion is like from that person's point of view.
This is not about proselytizing. This is about education.
Yes. It's only about understanding. We're trying to understand across so many different faith traditions, how are we alike? What do we have in common? And then what things are different about the ways that we believe or that our tradition is? And so, you know, it just gives people a chance to learn more about traditions that they may not know anything about. For instance, Sufi. Mm-hmm. Sufism. I didn't know anything about Sufism, but you can come there and you can learn about that and what that's all about. And that's what the day is all about.
I looked over the schedule and there's Sufism, and there's a Methodist, and then there's mm-hmm. the Unitarian Church,
right.
and the Episcopal Church.
Right.
18 in all, you say?
18 display tables. And then we also have the performances that go on all day. That's really a wonderful part of it because you just – you never know what's coming next. And the performances are 5 minutes. So you might have someone sing a hymn or read a story from their tradition. Various different things. We have a group that comes to dance. In fact, several that come and do a dance. It's very different every presentation to the next. And so people can come. It's a walk-in. You can just drop in, walk around, look at some tables, see some of the presentations. A few of the highlights will be that we will open. We will start at 2 o'clock. And we're excited to have Mayor Jordan. He's going to come and read a proclamation proclaiming this day as Interfaith Harmony Day. And the proclamation talks about how in our community, you know, we respect all the ways that we're diverse, and this is one of the ways that we're diverse.
And this is a great way to see a lot of the diversity
yes.
under one roof.
Yes, because, you know, even though we're talking about faith traditions, that's tied to culture in some ways. So we will have a lot of different cultures represented in the different displays and presentations.
There's a panel discussion too, right, moderated by John King?
Yes, it's going to be a really exciting panel. We have Buddhism represented, the Jewish faith, Christian faith, several different. There will be six speakers. And the question that we're posing to them, we've given them a specific question this year. Our theme this year is our sacred earth and her people. And so the question we're posing to the panelists is, how is nature honored in your faith tradition? That's it. And so they get to talk about whatever part of that they want to. And then we'll have some discussion at the end.
How did you find out who would participate?
Well, the Interfaith Harmony Day email list, it turns out, is quite long. There are a lot of different groups who intersect, I guess. For instance, one of the things that we do is there's a Northwest Arkansas Ministerial Association, and so we give the information to them. And they, I mean, there's a lot of different churches represented there, and so they pass the word out that way. But over the 4 years, you know, the email list has just grown with different people that wanted to be involved. And so it's quite a broad spectrum of people that are getting the emails.
And if someone looks at the list and perhaps the particular faith that they belong to is not represented, that does not mean that they're not welcome.
Oh, no, we would like them to represent that faith then. And yes, this year we're going to be pretty full in our hall. It's wonderful that this has grown so much in 4 years. And I get emails all the time from people who are like, we want to be there. We want to be involved. And there's a great enthusiasm for it. So I'm hoping that by next year we'll have to find a bigger place. to do it. And then we can have more tables, more display tables, more presentations, all of that. Everyone is invited to come. Everyone is invited to be involved. Even if you don't have a table this year, come and see what it's all about. I just think it's an inspirational experience. To me, it is.
Interfaith. That's very self-explanatory because it's many different faiths. Day, it's one day. Why the word harmony there in the middle?
To me, it's about expressing how we feel about our responsibility for interfaith harmony. I think all of the people that are part of this feel that it's not somebody else's responsibility, it's our responsibility. And so it's like we're just expressing that we believe that we want to live that. And so here's a day when you can learn about many different faith traditions. We're not saying, you know, you should change your faith tradition. It's just we want everyone to have the opportunity to learn about the different faiths.
Can you, and perhaps you can only speak for yourself, you can't speak for everyone that's involved, but can you, after spending 3.5 hours with people who are Christian and Muslim and Jewish and Hindi and Sufi and whatever else might be there, can you feel better about the world?
Well, I can tell you about my experience last year last year was the first time that I attended. And it was like that. About 2.5 hours into the day, I just stood there and looked around, you know, and there were all these people walking around and looking at displays and everything. And I just felt wonderful. It was so nice to have our little representation of this. You know, maybe we never achieve it worldwide, but we can always keep trying. And I think that's what all the people who come there are saying, you know, maybe we can't achieve it worldwide, but we can do this.
It's at the St. Paul's Parish Hall.
Mm-hmm. At St. Paul's Episcopal Church. It's on East Street. And visitors, when they come, will enter on the east side of the church in the Parish Hall area. And there's obviously no charge for this. We will have refreshments during the day, snacks and things like that available. And, yes, everyone is welcome.
And as you mentioned, no fee.
No charge at all. Just we want everyone to come who's interested in learning about other faith traditions that are right here in our area.
And you're allowed to ask questions at these tables.
Absolutely. They want to explain. Everybody who's there and has a table wants to explain what they're about. And they want to help you learn. So they welcome it for sure. Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Diane Cook is an organizer of the 4th Annual Interfaith Harmony Day. It takes place Saturday afternoon at St. Paul's Episcopal Church. Activities begin at 2 and will last until 5:30. The event is free and open to the public. Traditionally, late February is about the time when runners who prefer logging miles out of doors are just itching for a race. Not many 5K or 10K runs are scheduled for what is usually the chilliest time of the year. This year, a new 5K with an interesting backstory will be open to all runners on Saturday. The Community 5K and Fun Run began when members of the Congregation of the Community, a church based in Fayetteville, became interested in fitness. Diane Schultz, the race director and a member of the community, says at first people were exercising on their own. Then a few decided to run together. Then running for many of them became something of a passion.
We started running. We started meeting on Saturdays and running different parks here in Fayetteville. That's kind of how it started. And then we did our first 5K together, several of us, quite a few, in fact, about 13 of us did a 5K in Fort Smith. And I did it personally. I did it to support a young lady who was really excited about doing a 5K. And I thought, I'm not interested in doing organized races, but she was so excited. It was just my support of her. And lo and behold, I got hooked. I don't know what it is about races, but I was so excited, just the environment and the camaraderie and all that.
Many of the other runners in the church felt a similar enthusiasm and decided to train for a 10K, training that meant they were looking for a late winter tune-up.
Last year, in January, several of us were training for a 10K, and we needed a 5K at the end of January, and there were no 5Ks around. And so we thought, that's a good time to have a run if you're going to have one when nobody else is doing it.
The runners in the church began contemplating staging their own 5K in February. Their race, like most of those organized in the region, would benefit a nonprofit. And organizers didn't have to look far for a good fit.
Well, we incorporated in 2009.
Misty Newcomb is the director of Prism Education Center, a nonprofit dedicated to improving education and providing education opportunities for at-risk students. Misty is also a member of the Congregation of the Community Church.
We won several grants to do research and to practical research to look into what we could do in this particular region to create more options for parents in terms of educational programs for their children. Our emphasis has always been on low-income children. Yet, as a parent of kids who are, you know, who are not necessarily considered disadvantaged, mm-hmm. I want high-quality programs for them. And one of the things that we have found in our research is that really socioeconomic integration has a lot of benefits for all kids involved, and it really has no challenges as long as you build a strong culture. And so one of the things that we have found is that often there are programs that are specifically set apart for low-income kids, and those programs are sometimes lower quality than we think, you know, should be. And then there are programs for upper-income kids, and those are high-quality programs, but only people who can afford to get their kids in those programs can reap the benefit of that.
Misty Newcomb is one of the members of the congregation who began running relatively recently. She says she started as she was working on the beginnings of Prism Education Center, and those two activities complemented each other well.
And I was trying to develop perseverance inside and endurance, and so that's actually, honest to goodness, why I started running. And so this feels like a real perfect event for us because it encapsulates all of the things that Prism and the mm-hmm. kids and the reason that I started running and putting that all in together to support, you know, really the children of Northwest Arkansas.
As Misty's work involved in getting Prism Education Center functional led to her running, her desire to create more educational opportunities for children in Northwest Arkansas led to her work with Prism.
There are good programs in Northwest Arkansas, but I think people underestimate the need we have in Northwest Arkansas. We have a lot of families that work but still can't afford to you know, pay for their children to have childcare after school. And so a lot of kids go home when parents are not there because they're working to empty houses or to programs that parents don't necessarily prefer for their kids. And a lot of kids have academic needs that need to be addressed during that time. And it's kind of hard to do that, you know, when kids are in large groups. And so we wanted to kind of create a program that could really meet the needs of each individual child that came into our doors.
Many of the members of the community church, which meets weekly at the Boys and Girls Club in Fayetteville, will be volunteering at the run that begins Saturday morning at 8 a.m. in West Fork. For more information about the run, you can go to thecommunityrun.com. And for more information about Prism Education Center, prismeducationcenter.org.
This week in This American Life, for 6 months, Jaime was held captive in the middle of the jungle, a hostage, completely alone.
You see all those movies that Rambo just exercises when he's in jail, and you say, well, I'm going to start exercising. You start getting in shape, let me tell you, but you get bored.
Hostages, all kinds of hostages, this week.
This American Live, Saturday morning at 6 and Sunday morning at 10 on KUAF 91.3 FM. Jerry Sloan has talked about his poetry on this program before. It was just after the publication of his chapbook, Driving Through Fidelity. That was 1992. Now, 20 years later, his first full-length book of poetry has been published by Half Acre Press, and he'll read from that volume tomorrow night at 7 at Nightbird Books in downtown Fayetteville. Yesterday afternoon, he came by KUAF to talk about the book titled Paper Lanterns. The title poem refers to a story Jerry Sloan's father kept to himself for years.
My father was in the Navy in World War II and was in Hiroshima and Nagasaki within days of the nuclear bombing. He didn't share that with anybody in the family until I was in my mid-40s. My father passed away almost 5 years ago this summer. So even though the book is dedicated to my mother, who's still living, it tends to be the focus of the book is my relationship with my father, I think, and that's kind of the key poem that holds it all together, you know, the Paper Lanterns poem.
In that poem, there's the line about what he saw, and it's not just nothing. You write, nothing, nothing, nothing.
Well, that's maybe too Shakespearean. Initially, there was something that's a little more prosaic there, and one of my readers, again, tugged at my sleeve and said, this is not working, and so I thought about it. And it has a mirror in a poem on the previous page. I've never repeated a word in a poem before, but I have back-to-back poems in this collection, one called Dirigible, which ends with burning, 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 like the Buddha's holy vision. And then on the next page, you've got the paper lanterns and my father withholding this key information, I thought, in our attempts to communicate as father and son. And why did he withhold things that important? Nothing, nothing, nothing. You know, it tends to be typical of that generation. You know, they just didn't communicate. There's a couple other poems in the book about that, too. One called Herring Loss, which is based on a terrible pun, because the previous poem is about my son's hearing loss, and is the only found poem in the book, which is his actual science notes from the fifth grade about hearing, you know, what we hear and sound waves and whatnot.
So I'm sorry. The poem, sixth grade science notes?
Fifth grade, yeah.
Fifth grade. Right. It's, I think, on page 23. Those were actual notes.
Actual. That's a found poem. All I did is put a frame around it.
It's beautiful.
Well, I've had other people comment to that effect, so thank you.
The poem that I reread the most, and I don't know if that means I liked it the most, but the one that kept taking me back was Nature Channel.
Oh, really?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Would you mind reading that?
Nature Channel. You hesitate above the cluttered TV tray. The coyotes have come once more for the baby elk. The mother stands her ground for as long as possible, pausing between rounds to lick the baby's face. She knows deep down this signifies goodbye. There are five of them and only one of her. Patiently they circle the doomed pair in this ancient game whose rules are foreknown. And time, like some wind-up automaton, some merciless, predictable rerun, seems always on their side.
Some of your poems refer to people, places, or events in history that not everyone will instantly recognize.
Like the Forlorn Hope.
Like, right? Forlorn Hope, yeah. Mm-hmm. Which, and as you mentioned, those are
were the volunteers to go through the breach in the fortress wall during, you know, the Napoleonic Wars.
Who would literally become cannon fodder.
Yes, their chances of survival were virtually nil.
When you refer to Forlorn Hope or something like that, do you ever question, does it ever worry you that if someone doesn't know that historical or geographical reference?
Sure. Liz and I talked about maybe having a page of notes for obscure references. And in the last days before it went to press, you know, we decided to risk it and not over-explain things.
And I guess Forlorn Hope, even if you didn't know that historical reference, mm-hmm. those are still two words together that are
sure.
pretty hefty.
Yeah, it's like Faye Jones's Thorn Crown, you know, some of his pairings that mm-hmm. were kind of intuitive.
You know, speaking of two-word pairings, you know one that's in the book Paper Lanterns that I love? No. Is Furball Walenda.
Oh, really? Squirrels, yeah, I still see them daily.
And this is about walking the squirrels on the electrical line tight ropes.
Right, right. And I always think of a line from Baudelaire, you know, mon semblable, mon frère, you know, my brother, my likeness, and when I see those squirrels, because that's the perfect metaphor for you and I and everybody who lives in this crazy society of ours, you know. We're trying to balance our sanity and our health, you know, with all the stress and requirements of our jobs and family and responsibilities.
Do you mind reading another one of your choice?
Not at all. Another early reader accused me of not being afraid to show my dark side. And it doesn't seem like my dark side to me. It's just where I live, you know, but I was frowning even in my baby photographs. But I consider myself an optimist, a fierce optimist. A little poem later on that might call Residual Beauty. It's about some of the females in my life. Residual beauty. So slowly does it accrue that even you begin to notice after half a century. It manifests in the clothes you choose, the jewelry, the flowers conjured in your yard. Elusive, hard to startle, though you often do in dreams. It settles like a butterfly on thistle, becomes for one brief moment the focus of your attention. Something so utterly familiar that you're looking makes it new.
You mentioned someone commenting on your dark side. I've always thought you just had a very dry sort of sense of humor.
That term has come up many times. Thank you.
And I refer to almost the last page of this book when it's the bio. And you read through the bio, and at the end it says the author can be reached for the foreseeable future at this email address. I've never seen a contact with that phrase before.
I don't want to be presumptuous, you know. I may get run over crossing the street tomorrow. So, for the foreseeable future, you know, I wish the best for all of us.
Jerry Sloan's book of poetry is titled Paper Lanterns and is published by Half Acre Press. He'll read from the book tomorrow night at 7 at Nightbird Books on Dixon Street in Fayetteville.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 22nd of February, 2012. It is the birthday of George Washington, Westmoreland County, Virginia, 1732, whose favorite foods were mashed sweet potatoes with coconut, string beans with mushrooms, cream of peanut soup, salt cod, and pineapples. He lost all of his teeth except for one by cracking Brazil nuts between his teeth and got dentures made out of a hippopotamus tusk and was constantly in pain, which he alleviated with the use of opium. It's the birthday of the philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer, born in Danzig, now Gdansk, Poland, 1788. Family was Dutch. His father was a successful merchant and shipowner, his mother a writer and a friend of Goethe. The family moved to Hamburg, and the boy apprenticed in the family business, but when he was 17, his father died, and Schopenhauer left the business to study philosophy at the University of Berlin. Schopenhauer, who believed that human reason is limited, that the universe is essentially unknowable, that happiness is an illusion, our desires can never truly be satisfied, and the only way to attain peace is by keeping low expectations. He believed that the nature of life is suffering, so happiness is simply freedom from suffering. He also believed that women were childish and meant to obey. Schopenhauer never married. It's the birthday of Edna St. Vincent Millay, born in Rockland, Maine, 1892. She was in high school when she read her poem Renaissance at a poetry reading, and a woman in the audience was so impressed that she paid Edna's way to go to Vassar College, a poem that begins, "The world stands out on either side, no wider than the heart is wide. Above the world is stretched the sky, no higher than the soul is high." It was on this day in 1878 Frank Woolworth opened the first of his 5-cent stores in Utica, New York. The store went under by May of that year, and he tried again the next year, this time in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and included some merchandise priced at a dime, so it came to be called the Dime Store. It was different from traditional stores in that the merchandise was out there on tables where shoppers could pick it up and look at it. It was not hidden in a back room behind a counter. And it was on this date in 1632, Galileo published his book Dialogue Concerning the Two Chief World Systems. in which, as gently as possible, he argued against the belief of the Church that the earth was not the center of the universe, and that, in fact, the sun is the center of the solar system and the earth is circling around it. The book was placed on the Church's Index of Forbidden Books the following year. Galileo was tried, convicted of heresy, and spent the rest of his life under house arrest. Here's a poem for today by Barton Sutter, The Thousand-Foot Oar Boat. To live until we die, the job seems just impossible. The great weight of the past pushing us forward, the long future thrust out before us, and so little room to either side. The least we can do is stay sober, look sharp. The 1,000-foot oar boat slides through the ship canal and eases beneath the bridge, all engines thrumming, including the pilot's heart. A poem by Barton Sutter, The 1,000-foot oar boat, from Farewell to the Starlight and Whiskey, published by Boa Editions Limited and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, celebrating 100 years of discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. Edited by Noah Smith, written by Holly Vanderhaar. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support for Ozarks at Large and KUAF is provided by the Center for Arkansas Regional Studies at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, dedicated to the celebration and documentation of this region's history and culture.
A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Harmony.
Where is Harmony?
It is northeast, a little bit of Huntsville.
Madison County.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Let's see. Ithi Agnihotri Madolker will be in here tomorrow.
She will.
And you and I will be back together on Friday.
We will. How was your night last night? You went to the Million Dollar Quartet?
Million Dollar Quartet opened last night at Walton Arts Center. I did go. And, you know, of course, Cody Slaughter from Harrison plays Elvis.
Talked
to him.
We've
had him on the program in the past few days. I thought a highlight of the show was, and I should have his name in front of me, I apologize for not, was the gentleman who plays Sam Phillips, the founder of Sun Records. And the show is mostly music. It's music of that era. It's Johnny Cash singing I Walk the Line and things like that. But I thought the interesting part, the most interesting part, was kind of delving into Sam Phillips as he's seeing his empire, not empire, but the label he built kind of move on. Elvis has already signed away. You find out that some other people have gone. And sort of a consideration, what is selling out and what is not, which has been a question in rock and roll since it began. And
right. But maybe so, a little different perspective.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. It's
an interesting show, yes.
Yes.
I
didn't really do anything.
Okay. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I think we'll have a question tomorrow. Didn't have a chance today. But I should mention that it was 32 years ago today that the U.S. hockey team beat the Soviet Union in the Lake Placid Olympics. One interesting fact, that was not the gold medal game, by the way. That was just the semifinals. That was to
But that was the miracle on ice.
Miracle on ice. That was to get into the gold medal game. Right. Al Michaels' famous call. Do you believe in miracles?
Yes.
Yes.
So there's your history fact for the day.
There you go. All right. Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks, Kyle.
Craig able to get a piece of it to sweep it away. 28 seconds. The crowd going insane. Carlomar. Shooting it into the American end again. Morrow is back there. Now Johnson. 19 seconds. Johnson over to Ramsey. Will you let the knock get checked by Ramsey? McClanahan is there. The puck is still loose. 11 seconds. You've got 10 seconds. The countdown going on right now. Morrow up to Schultz. 5 seconds left in the game.
Over.
You believe in miracles? Yes!